I'm Kara Miller. Welcome back to Innovation Hub, the show where we talk with some of today's most innovative thinkers. Mobile computing, whether from a smartphone or your iPad, is fundamentally changing our lives and the institutions that we work at and shop at, but it may also be altering the future in ways that we can't yet anticipate, revolutionizing education and healthcare and commerce. Michael Saylor is the CEO of MicroStrategy and author of The Mobile Wave. Michael Saylor, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Kara.
So I'm going to have you start off the way that you start off your book, which is a conversation with your niece, where you realize how much teenage girls and CEOs are alike in how they approach mobile computing at times. What was that conversation that spurred you down this path?
You know, my niece was, she was in junior high, and she was visiting New York City as a birthday present from her mother and my sister. And we're sitting in a cafe in Union Square, and I said to her, "So how do you like the Big Apple?" You know, and that's probably a question that would have elicited the same response for about 100 years. And she looked up at me and she goes, "Well, I like the new operating system, and I want one for my birthday." And I just sat back in shock. First, I didn't register, like, what was she talking about? Because I was waiting for her to say something about Times Square or tall buildings. And then it occurred to me that for her, the Big Apple is an iPad coming from the Apple Computer Corporation. And so I followed up on that train of reasoning a bit, and I said, "So why do you want an iPad?" She goes, "Well, you know, I can carry around all these books on it, do my homework on it, surf the web on it, and all my friends have one." This is 3 months after Apple launched the first iPad, so about 2 years ago, and 90 days into the delivery of a completely revolutionary new device. And so I said, "All your friends have one?" She's a junior high girl.
Right.
And she goes, "All my friends have one." I said, "Well, how many is that?" She goes, "Hundreds." And at that point, it occurred to me that this was something much, much bigger than anybody had the courage to articulate. And I started to think about ways to get ahead of this wave and invest in it. And it got my brain working, considering what this meant to the entire civilization in general.
You also talk about the price, which is pretty high for a tablet computer or even an iPhone. And at the time, you know, you were looking at about a $500 price tag, which, you know, people might think that is pretty steep. I mean, I have books and I have music and maybe I don't need to trade it in. But it's interesting, the sort of the way that you analyze that $500 price tag.
You have to put this in perspective to what it's doing. If you have an iPad in your hand, you also have potentially 20 million books that are free in your hand. It costs $4,000 on average for the textbooks people use to get through college. High school textbooks cost about $1,000. An iPad allows you to read a book for free. And because of the idiosyncrasies of copyright law, anything that's nonfiction that looks like a textbook is inevitably going to go to zero in price, because you can't protect the price on a calculus book or a physics book. Isaac Newton wrote everything there was to be known about calculus hundreds of years ago, and you can just go copy his stuff. So the summary is, if you're holding an iPad in your hand, you're holding a free library in your hand. The library is worth a lot more than $500. In that respect, it's not so expensive. But if you look at it another way, it's 1,000 times cheaper to wire the world with mobile radio waves than to wire the world with copper. So when you compare the cost of computing on a tablet computer versus the cost of computing using a desktop PC, we take this for granted, but you're probably looking at a $10,000 expense or more to surf the web on a PC. Because by the time you add up the furniture and the cubicle and the office space and the HVAC and the electric power plug that's 10 feet away from you, all of that stuff is about $10,000 to $20,000 of infrastructure. So when we give someone a $500 tablet, we're giving them something which is anywhere from 10 to 20 times cheaper than the next best way to get it done. But of course, that really understates it, because you don't want to read a book on a PC or a laptop. You want to read a book on an iPad or a Kindle.
I always thought of tablets as sort of a smaller, more convenient laptop computer. Inconvenient only in the sense that if you want to type something to somebody, it can be a little tougher to do it on a tablet. But the way you think of tablets is fundamentally different than a laptop computer. And you point to people who are in their 70s, for example, and have not taken easily to computers, but take easily to tablets. Why the difference?
It's a good point. The mobile wave is the fifth wave of computing. The first wave was the mainframe, the second was the mini computer, the third was the PC, and the fourth was the internet-linked computer. All of those had one thing in common, which is they were all in the domain of the fairly rich white-collar worker in the Western world working in an office environment, and you would access those kind of computers 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, and probably the people using those computers were between the ages of 20 and 45. They had good eyesight. They had to be fairly well-educated. There was no 8-year-old running a mainframe or a mini computer back 20 years ago. Now, what's different about the mobile wave is the fifth wave of computing is basically the opening of Pandora's box and the explosion of software outside of the white-collar office environment. Now you've got 3-year-olds that are using these devices, and you've got 90-year-olds, and for good reason. No 90-year-old wants to use a computer because they're hard to get around, and on the other hand, reading a newspaper on an iPad when you're 90 years old is maybe the only way to do it. You can expand the print by a factor of 4 to 10 by pinching and zooming in a matter of a second. A real newspaper doesn't do that. And on the other hand, if I'm a 3-year-old, I can't even read, but the iPad will read itself. And so if I'm 4 years old and I'd like to learn Japanese or Spanish, an iPad might very well teach me. I'm not even strong enough to hold up a laptop, and I probably can't afford one, or my parents can't afford one. And to process things in the PC world requires incredible symbolic thinking skills, the skills that come from having mastered mathematics and mastered reading and mastered logic. These are things that you haven't mastered when you're 3 years old. And so I remember it's the most funny thing in the world. I'm walking down the beach in Saint-Tropez, and I see a 3-year-old kid in a stroller. And they're sitting and playing with an iPad. And I leaned over and I said, "So what are you doing?" And the kid goes, "I'm working on my music." Now, can you imagine a 3-year-old in a stroller working on their music on any instrument or working on their music on a PC? Not at all. And so what we're seeing right now is this software is an order of magnitude easier to use. And that brings it into the domain of the blind, or the domain of the autistic, or the domain of the young, or the domain of the old. And these are all domains where Windows running on a laptop was never accessible. And so, that, in a way, is revolutionary.
So let's talk about some of those domains. I'm talking about mobile computing, the mobile wave, and how it's going to change the world. Michael Saylor, my guest, is CEO of MicroStrategy and author of The Mobile Wave. So let's talk about some of those expanding domains. One of them that you talk about, as you've been sort of talking about here, is with younger people, education. We do know that iPads are being used to a certain degree in schools in the U.S. There's been some discussion of using them for autistic kids who may not be able to interface with a person as well as they can with a screen. But you talk about Singapore and other places that are doing some really interesting things in education. What have you seen in terms of how mobile is being used for education that you think is really interesting?
Well, I have to say that I think that education is poised for a massive revolution, the biggest change in hundreds of years. We still teach people the same way we did 30 years ago, 50 years ago, even 100 years ago. And the thing that's coming about is the dematerialization of textbooks, the dematerialization of the educational process itself. Now, as long as a textbook is manufactured on paper locally, and as long as teaching is delivered by a person locally, it's subject to the local laws of the country. It's subject to the school board regulations of some local community school board. It's subject to the local religious preferences of whoever runs the country or the city. And it's subject to the controls of any local strongman that wants to shake down the local printer in order to get some kind of kickback. In essence, education as a locally manufactured product across 5 billion people around the world is very inefficient, very expensive, and very biased and prejudiced. You know, the education that someone in Pakistan gets, or India gets, or China gets, or Turkey gets, is going to be a function of those local governments and all those local constraints. On the other hand, what I've noticed with the iPad is I can give a 6-year-old an iPad, they can go to Khan Academy, and they can get their own education, and they can bypass the local school board, the local government, the local teachers union, the local parents, as well as their local teachers. So not only can they get education direct from a source that's outside of their country's borders, they can get it for free. They can get it at their own rate.
I should explain that Khan Academy was started by a guy, Salman Khan, who has gotten backing from Bill Gates, among other people. And he offers these short, very concise, clear lessons in all sorts of things, from history to math. And it's been incredibly popular, Khan Academy.
Extremely, to the point where 100 million sessions have taken place. Now, in my book, what I'm really writing about is the second-order impact of software running on mobile devices. And the big picture is the dematerialization of half of the economy. Half of everything that every human on the face of the earth does is about to be impacted by software. So in the domain of education, consider, say, my own life. I grew up in a middle-class American family, and I went to American public schools. And if you were to put that on the scale of the other 7 billion people on the planet, I would suppose that I had an education that was better than 95% of them. I was the first in my class, and I was smart enough to win a scholarship, but all of the American educational system could not provide me with the ability to learn a foreign language before I was 14 years old. And when I got to age 14, I was given the choice of Spanish or French, and I could learn 4 semesters of that sitting in a classroom at the same speed as 30 other people.
Right.
And that was the educational offering of the American system to a upper middle class child, right, when I was growing up. And it's substantially similar today in most parts of the world. You just don't have a choice. If you're a 6-year-old and you wanted to learn Russian or Chinese or English, you don't have a choice. But if I give you a tablet computer, you have the choice potentially of 100 different languages, whether your parents want you to learn it or not, whether or not you can afford to pay $10,000 a year or not. You don't have to go at the same rate as of the 30 average people in your class, and you don't have to wait 10 years. And we know from education that if you learn a language before age of 10, it's possible that you'll learn it fluently. After the age of 10, you'll probably have an accent. After the age of 20, it becomes 20, 30 times harder.
And we certainly see not just Khan Academy, but Harvard and MIT teaming up to offer online free classes starting this fall. And it will be really interesting, I think, to see where those classes are viewed. I know with Khan Academy, I think there's a lot of viewing in China and India, which may have restrictive school systems, but where people are interested in, let's say, learning English or in going beyond what they might be able to get in their local village.
Yeah, I think education should be free. Now, if you come from a rich country and you've come from a rich background and you went to Harvard, you might very well say, well, that's not as good as Harvard. But it misses the point entirely. 3 billion people on the planet are living on less than $900 a year. Those people aren't paying $50,000 a year to go to Harvard or Princeton or anywhere, for that matter. Those people have no chance of improving their life unless you can get the cost of an education down into the range of $100 a year. And you can get it to $100 a year if you buy a $200 or $300 or $400 tablet computer, keep it for 5 years, and maybe share it with one other person and put it on a local Wi-Fi network. At that point, the cost of education via Sailor.org or Wikipedia or Khan Academy or what MIT is currently giving away via MITx or Google, the cost of all those things start to look free. And now we have a mechanism for billions of people to achieve not just a college degree, but potentially an advanced degree. I think that's the essence of progress in a civilization, the point at which we don't have 100 million people just digging ditches in order to grow crops.
You also talk about it changing commerce as well as education, all sorts of things. And one of the interesting examples, and this is actually where commerce and health intersect, but you imagine sort of the possibility of living in a city in the U.S., let's say Boston, but having a doctor in Bangalore, India, and you've accomplished that through a mobile device. How, in this new wave of mobile devices, would that work, that you'd be sitting in Boston and you'd have a doctor in India?
Well, the cost of any given profession is, to a certain degree, a function of the cost of living of that professional. So if I'm a highly trained, expensively educated doctor in the United States, and if I spent $50,000 to $100,000 a year to get through medical school, I've got to make $250,000 to $300,000 a year just to pay back my loans. And then I've got to make more to live in that apartment in Boston or that apartment in New York City. You know what it costs for an apartment in downtown Boston?
Right.
Well, as I was saying, it doesn't cost that much if I go to a city in the middle of China or if I go to the city in the middle of India. And also, the reason it costs so much to get educated in medicine is because the people doing the educating have to be paid a lot. So as we move professions offshore to other jurisdictions where it doesn't cost that much to live, then the cost to produce a doctor decreases and the cost to maintain a doctor decreases. On the other hand, the laws of physics apply everywhere on Earth. You know, chemistry, physics, calculus, biology, immunology, they work the same everywhere on Earth. It's just that it costs more money if you happen to be living in Manhattan. So if I have a question, I want to call a doctor and ask him, you know, well, what do I do about this cough? He wants to look at me. Well, now you can look at someone via the camera on an iPad, you know, so you could literally be having a FaceTime session with someone 1,000 miles away. For many, many activities, let's say reading an x-ray. You know, a doctor in Australia can read an x-ray just as well as a doctor in New York City. It turns out if you have a CAT scan in downstate Virginia at midnight on a Saturday night, they will actually send that file to an Australian doctor right now and get the result back in 15 minutes because it's daylight there. What doctor wants to work at 1 in the morning in the United States? If so, that person's making a sacrifice and they're going to cost more. So we're looking at a world where you can speak to a doctor around the world. You can submit a file. You know, someone needs to read your EKG. They need to look at your blood chemistry results, but that person doesn't need to speak English necessarily. And by the way, if they do need to speak English, there are a lot of people in the world that speak English that don't live in America. And so I think that that's the revolution in healthcare that's coming. People just can't afford an expensive professional in the middle of Manhattan.
And as you say, with iPads, you know, you obviously can take pictures. You could do something potentially like a Skype. So they could look at the rash on your hand. I mean, they can get pretty close to you. The only thing they can't do is physically put their hands on you. But like you said, there's an awful lot that if you think about it, a doctor could see in an appointment with you, even if the doctor was in Bangalore, India.
And the world is morphing, right, to a hybrid approach, right? There is a benefit for you to have a doctor who can put their hand on you. On the other hand, there's a lot of stuff they do, like they take blood, they take an x-ray, they take a CAT scan. That stuff needs to be read by a skilled radiologist. You don't need to be a radiologist to take the CAT scan. You need to be a radiologist to interpret the result. And so in the old world, in the last generation, all those people had to be on site. The radiologist had to be at the hospital at midnight standing next to the nurse. And the person to interpret the blood work, to interpret the x-ray, had to be there. And that means expensive local creation of this medical service. At the point that they don't have to be on site, then you can actually chop up the medical service into a number of parts and you can move them, in essence, manufacture a medical result at a much, much lower cost. In some cases, the software itself does the diagnosis. In other cases, we move the information somewhere on Earth where there's someone who can do it better. And by the way, it's not just moving it to a lower cost jurisdiction. You know, if I'm a skilled radiologist and I can read 100 x-rays an hour, and I'm standing at your local hospital, I only get one an hour, right? I'm idling. And so part of this is about making people more efficient.
And the interesting thing, too, is the reach here, which I didn't realize that we have 7 billion people in the world. Last year, 5.3 billion of them had cell phones. That's 70% of the population. Where do you see that going?
I think within a decade, just about every literate person on this earth is going to have a smartphone and they're going to have a tablet computer that has the functionality of an iPad. And I think that because it's now cheaper to learn to read with one of those devices than without. So the most exciting and interesting thing here, by the way, for Americans is at that point, the best product is going to be an English language, probably American piece of software. And so the mobile wave is delivering the American language, it's delivering the American currency, and it's delivering American values to those 6 billion people who otherwise would be required to utilize a local service or local product manufactured very expensively that doesn't work so well, that reflects their local political and local values, whatever they may be. So I think the mobile wave is going to be an extraordinary boon for moving progressive Western thought and extraordinarily powerful Western ideas and products throughout the rest of the world to lift the civilization up.
That's an interesting future conversation. Are we looking at, in a lot of ways, the mobile wave being the English wave? We've been talking about the future of the mobile world, and I've been speaking with Michael Saylor, the CEO of MicroStrategy and the author of The Mobile Wave. Michael Saylor, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Kara.
And coming up this week, join us for our first live Innovation Hub event at the Modern Theater in Boston. We'll be talking about how robotics and automation are changing our lives and our economy. We'll have some fantastic inventors, as well as a renowned author who wonders if the rise of machines in everything from healthcare to manufacturing could further divide the haves and the have-nots. In fact, he says, it may already be happening. Tickets are limited, but I hope you'll join us for a fascinating and interactive conversation on September 27th. That is this Thursday night. You can find out more at wgbh.org/innovationhub. I'm Kara Miller, and this is Innovation Hub.